Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest revelation from the explosive testimony by a whistleblower before a UK parliamentary committee looking into Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, in which Christopher Wylie mentioned that senior officials from Palantir, a company founded by Peter Thiel, that does secret work for the NSA and other intelligence agencies, worked with Cambridge Analytica on both the Brexit and Trump campaigns. Frank Pasquale, a professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information, joins us to discuss how much a pivotal role Peter Thiel played in getting Trump elected, not in terms of the billionaire founder of PayPal and early investor in Facebook donating money, but in terms of being a key strategist. At the very least, Trump thought Thiel was important enough to be given a prominent role as a speaker at the Republican convention, and Thiel was the only member, along with David Koch, outside of the Trump family to celebrate the returns on election night in Trump Tower. Then we'll speak with Kathy Fung, the executive director of California Common Cause, who played a leadership role in reforming California's redistricting process along nonpartisan lines. She was in the Supreme Court today as justices heard arguments in a watershed gerrymandering case and joins us to discuss the new census form for 2020, which appears to be designed by the Trump administration to make sure that the undocumented, the young, and minorities are not counted. In spite of the Constitution being clear on counting all persons in the United States, the Republicans seem determined in the face of demographic changes to use voter suppression and a census undercount to reduce the number of Democratic congressional districts and maintain their advantage through gerrymandering. Then finally, we'll discuss the meeting between Kim Jong-un and China's President Xi Jinping, which appears to have cleared the way for a summit between North Korea's leader and President Trump in May. Stephen Norper, a professor at Columbia University who was a senior analyst at the State Department, joins us to discuss who is laying the groundwork for this upcoming summit, given the hollowing out of expertise at the State Department, and whether there will be enough staff work to restrain Trump from agreeing to something to make himself look good rather than act in the interest of the U.S. and its allies. And joining us now is Frank Pasquale, who's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. He serves on the advisory boards of the Data Competition Institute, Patient Privacy Rights, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And he's the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Pasquale.
Great to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, Frank. And this testimony from Christopher Wylie before a UK parliamentary committee has just got people spellbound in the UK, and it's extremely explosive stuff. I mean, one of the things that he revealed was that the predecessor to this, Alexander Nix, the head of Cambridge Analytica, that just had to step down, that his predecessor, Wylie claims, was murdered in Kenya. He made it clear that, which a lot of people have suspected, that Cambridge Analytica worked on the Brexit campaign along with the Russians as a kind of rehearsal for their work on the Trump campaign. And he also mentioned that senior people from Palantir, a company founded by Peter Thiel that does secret work for the NSA and other intelligence agencies, worked with Cambridge Analytica. So I'm beginning to feel that Peter Thiel is more and more a key figure in this whole Trump election story, not just because he's a billionaire and an early investor in Facebook, not to mention a founder or co-founder of PayPal, but I think in terms of the strategy that he may well have been a more important strategist than Stephen Bannon was.
I think that there is some incredibly important connections. There are some incredibly important connections here to be made. And, you know, I have to preface my comments by saying that, you know, I haven't seen all the documentation of what Wylie has asserted. You know, I have read the New York Times story and some other items, and I want to watch the full testimony. But in general, I think that what we're now seeing is the way that some of these super connectors, these Flexians, as Janine Waddell calls them, people that travel between the worlds of politics and the academy and big business, how they are able to manipulate our reality. And I think that this is a really important revelation that we desperately need to follow up on to understand more about, you know, and the other thing that's really critical here is, you know, you have, we had an earlier New York Times reporting about Alex Stamos being upset in 2016 about the Russian situation, sort of Russian manipulation of Facebook. And apparently in the article, Sheryl Sandberg and some other factions within Facebook tried to tamp him down. What's remarkable about that story, by the way, is that they changed it. They took out Sheryl Sandberg's name later without issuing a correction. At least that's the last thing I saw, which is highly irregular and very interesting, you know, in terms of like what exactly is going on there and what power might Facebook have over the press itself that's worried about how it's showing up in Facebook algorithms. But nevertheless, you know, we understand that like the Facebook, the internal politics of it, it's a black box. It's far more opaque than the Kremlin ever was at any point of its, you know, operation and in the USSR. And we just don't know what are the who are the factions within Facebook, what are they pushing, how are they influencing our understanding and the general understanding of social reality. Those are very important questions we have to follow up on.
But my sense is that you could develop a scenario, and this is at the risk of getting a bunch of Hollywood screenwriters all exercised here since we're sitting, I'm talking to you from across the street from Universal Studios, but you could develop a scenario in which Peter Thiel, who is, as I mentioned, is on the board of Facebook, one of the early investors, something happened with Facebook that was very critical, and that was that somebody, I think, on the Republican side, whoever it was, and it's not quite clear, buffaloed Facebook into this accepting this canard that Facebook's human curation of its news was liberally biased. Now, that was obviously key because Facebook provides something like 2/3 to 3/4 of the news to most Americans. That in itself is a frightening statistic. So Zuckerberg then rolled and caved preemptively and then brought in algorithms. And that allowed Cambridge Analytica, who were all ready to go, they'd already had their rehearsal with Brexit, to hit the ground running with fake news, augmented and amplified by Russian bots. And we know that the rest is history. And of course, we know the rest is history because it just recently came out from the revelations that this Russian academic got 50 million Facebook users and their friends' information, which was used by the Trump campaign in those three key swing states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. So that's just the beginning of the scenario. But let's comment on that part, because I thought that Facebook caving over this ridiculous claim that human curation of their news was biased in a liberal direction was the sort of the thing that opened the floodgates.
It was, and I want to actually go back to that, because there is a very interesting story to be told about the meme, the sort of rumor that was sort of spreading around in early 2016 that Silicon Valley in general was biased in favor of the Democrats. So just to take us back in a little time machine, you know, to early 2016, lots of folks were saying, oh, Eric Schmidt has it, really wants to see Hillary Clinton elected. Then you had the big bombshell story in Gizmodo that was rather thinly sourced, right? I mean, this was a pretty thinly sourced story in Gizmodo that said one of the human curators complained about a bias that may well have been an actual sense of professional responsibility among the human curators not to spread horrific fake news. That continues to this day, right? I mean, the poor Parkland high school kids are having this horrific fake news spread about them constantly, and Facebook just is not investing what it needs to stop that. In any event, that thinly sourced story was seized upon by the Senate. The Senate brought in folks to testify, and you know, I have to confess, I am someone that watches the bias of tech, and when I saw that come out, I thought briefly, well, at least this will dramatize the question of the bias of tech firms. But I, in my wildest imaginings at that point, was not really aware of the possibility that, hey, who knows exactly how this all got put together, but certainly folks who are very strategic, and I would include Peter Thiel among them, could easily have seized upon that as an opportunity to push for algorithmic curation, which was utterly vulnerable to exactly the type of things that you're describing, all the fake news, all the targeting, all the psychometrics of an entity like Cambridge Analytica. And so I think that we really have to think deeply about how this works. And, you know, I was pretty early out of the gate saying algorithmic curation is not working. You've got to have human curators. But there is a way in which it's very easy for the business interests of Facebook and for the most manipulative, unscrupulous political players to interact, and the way that though, and to reinforce one another. And the way that works is, you know, if you have Facebook being like, well, we don't want to spend money on actual human curators, and we don't want to take the political heat for any sort of human judgment, just saying, well, the algorithms did it. And then you simultaneously have the development of extremely sophisticated, high data-driven, high resource-intensive campaigns to find and manipulate people that are usually, you know, the voter suppression campaigns that Steve Bannon bragged about in Michigan and Pennsylvania, targeting these ads, you know, targeting very misleading ads saying, you know, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, what's the big difference? Hillary said super predator once, so, you know, they just don't even vote. They knew exactly how to target those ads in states where the difference was sort of razor thin, right? 10,000 votes in one of those states. I think it was Michigan. So I think this is a situation where, you know, we are really relearning. And when the story is told in the end, we're going to have a much different story of how all those things interacted than was common. I also just wanted to say one other thing that just is a pet peeve of mine is that there are so many knowing, smug communications academics that, you know, are saying things like, well, who knows, you know, or how can we prove that these things actually affected people? It's all, no one could even know that. And, you know, I just find those sorts of interventions incredibly unconvincing because there are a lot of people that just barely follow politics or barely involved at all. And, you know, seeing a few of these voter suppression ads could make all the difference to whether, you know, you decide to take the time out of your day to actually go and vote or just stay home and watch an extra TV show or something. So I think we really have to have a much more sensitivity to the ways in which manipulation of the media can cause profound political shifts, as we saw in 2016 with both Trump and Brexit.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Pasquale. He's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information by rapidly changing technology. He serves on the advisory boards of the Data Competition Institute and Patient Privacy Rights and the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and is the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. But just turning to the revelation from Christopher Wiley about Palantir, Peter Thiel's company, having their top people working with Cambridge Analytica and the Russian academic, who Wiley says was the go-between between Facebook, the Trump campaign, and the Russian GRU, who are the ones that hacked the DNC and the email of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. So that's pretty extraordinary. Again, it develops. I mean, I know conspiracy theorists always confuse, they put the cart before the horse, that intentions determine outcomes as opposed to outcomes determining intentions, which is what the 9/11 conspiracy is, that because it helped Bush and Cheney get elected, therefore they were behind it. In this case, there's no question that Peter Thiel was given a prominent role at the Republican convention, and he was also, along with David Koch, the only other person outside of the Trump family to celebrate the returns on election nights. But let's just go to what's been revealed today in the UK by Christopher Wiley. What do you think is the significance of that, of the Palantir connection? Doesn't that bring Thiel right into the mix there?
Well, I want to get to your Russian point first and then talk a bit about the Thiel-Palantir thing. I mean, we do have to acknowledge that, you know, the Palantir is saying, well, this one of the employees involved was just acting in his personal capacity, et cetera. you know, whether that would involve more investigation, et cetera. To get to your point about conspiracy theory, I spent some time actually talking with folks at Cambridge University, their Center for Research on Arts, Social Sciences, and Humanities, who had a special grant to study conspiracy theories in politics. David Runciman was one of the people there. He runs the Talking Politics podcast, one of the leading commentators in Britain on conspiracy theory. And I think he would agree that, I mean, I think that, you know, leading experts on conspiracy theory would agree with you about the problems and temptations of trying to weave a web of connections and causal inference that is convenient and, you know, lumps all of one's enemies into one big grouping that is all working together toward nefarious ends. That said, we really need to acknowledge, and this was the whole point of my book, The Black Box Society, that there is such opacity at the core of leading political and economic institutions like Facebook, like these sort of data brokers and political consultancies and other things, that it's very hard to really understand what is going on and what all the connections are between different entities and the commercial and the personal and other incentives that are going on. And what I would say here is that, you know, this story has a discussion of Eric Schmidt's daughter, who was an intern with them, and, you know, the Eric Schmidt being the former chairman of Google, still with many ties there, et cetera. You know, I think that we just have to be very careful, and we have to keep investigating and keep pushing for journalism that can fully understand the big picture. Because if it does turn out that there was a teal push on multiple fronts, say at Facebook, at between Palantir and SCL, you know, getting the most advanced data analytics to SCL or otherwise advising, and these epical campaigns, that is incredibly important information for us to understand about the nature of the power of Silicon Valley. You know, and that's something that it is a big story. It's something that's going to need continuous follow-up. And if anyone tries to dismiss all these connections as a conspiracy theory, you know, that in itself, I think, is quite suspicious dismissal, because it suggests something to hide. And, you know, it suggests that they wheel out that sort of an accusation, given all of the fascinating connections we already have, and given what we know about Thiel's ideology and his willingness to try to put private business interests to work and also what we know about his secret campaign to kill Gawker, right? Yeah. I mean, it isn't like this is someone who, you know, has just been your average upstanding normal business executive. This is someone who had, once, you know, Gawker angered him a few, one or two too many times, cooked up an enormously complex lawsuit, you know, with very low odds of succeeding, I might add. I mean, I'm someone that has studied.
But he put a press organ out of business, which certainly is not something to look kindly on. I'll just finish up with another conspiracy theory, Frank. Palantir, of course, is named after the all-seeing eye in Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings was filmed in New Zealand, and Peter Thiel just bought a big chunk of New Zealand to ride out the apocalypse, which I think is highly ironic, since Donald Trump is most likely to precipitate an apocalypse, and Peter Thiel certainly played a role in electing him. So I'll leave you on that somewhat less than serious note.
I mean, I do hope that you can link in the show notes to an amazing Guardian story about the Silicon Valley billionaires who are buying up New Zealand to wait out the end of the world, which includes just an extraordinary picture of both Thiel, but also connecting Thiel's love of New Zealand to a guy named Rees Mogg that wrote a book called The Sovereign Individual of the 90s. Modern followers of British politics will know his son, Jacob Rees-Mogg, as one of the sort of wild Brexiteers, one of the most outlandish of them all, or most, you know, pushing it as hard as possible. And so it's just astonishing to see that, you know, this sort of like libertarian manifesto that was seen as just a far out bizarro account of the world in the late 90s, this book, The Sovereign Individual, that predicted and cheered on the death of nation states and the unraveling of global political orders, that the son of the person that wrote that, you know, is now wreaking havoc in UK politics, and that you have the Silicon Valley billionaire who, you know, is connected to so many of these different entities that are really changing the face of media and politics, migrates or, you know, has this citizenship in New Zealand in part because the father, Rees Mogg, the Southern libertarian figure from the 90s, deeply influenced political reform, so-called reform there, to make it a neoliberal wonderland. So the connections here are really critical, right. And, you know, it's good to see journalists drawing them.
Well, I hope they do, and I thank you for joining us, Frank Pasquale.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Frank Pasquale. He's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. And he's the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking at the new census form for 2020, which appears to be designed by the Trump administration to make sure that the undocumented, the young, and minorities are not counted. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kathy Fung, who is the Executive Director of California Common Cause. She co-authored and played a leadership role in winning the passage of Proposition 11 to reform California's redistricting process and sits on the Secretary of State's Advisory Committee for the Help America Vote Act. And she was in the Supreme Court today as the justices heard arguments in a watershed gerrymandering case. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kathy Fung.
Thank you, Ian.
And obviously I wanted to talk to you about how the Secretary of Commerce has inserted, probably at the behest of the Attorney General, a questionnaire in the census that seems to be designed to intimidate non-voting and non-citizens in this country from mm-hmm. filling out the census form for the 2020 mm-hmm. census. But mm-hmm. let's just touch on what you saw today in the Supreme Court, because that is key. It was, after all, the last census in 2010 mm-hmm. that the Republicans were well prepared for, with Karl Rove, with an enormous backing from the American Petroleum Institute, along with the Koch brothers and their front group, ALEC. They were able to hit the ground running and get all of the state legislatures aboard and get them elected, both with governorships and in the state assemblies. And as we know, that's when the massive Republican gerrymandering took place. So if there is to be any redress from the court, then that would, of course, be a great thing, although a lot of people aren't holding their breath because of the Republican domination of the court. But on the other hand, the Democrats have got to do something in 2020 to fight back, to make up for the lost ground in terms of gerrymandering. So it's an extremely important case that's before the court. What was your sense of the arguments today?
The key question that the Supreme Court has been struggling with for a while is, can the Supreme Court find a constitutional violation when it comes to partisan gerrymandering? It's clear that when we're dealing with other areas that are somewhat similar, like racial gerrymandering, gerrymandering, manipulation of the district lines to benefit one particular group at the expense of another, right? In the racial context, that the court has said that they can act. But when it comes to partisan gerrymandering, the courts have always stopped shy of being able to act because there had been a portion of the Supreme Court that had said, well, partisan and political actions have been part and parcel of the political process, right? And to some extent, our country has been built on this notion that the winner takes all the spoils. And when it comes to redistricting, if you control the majority of a legislature, you get to draw the lines for the legislature, Congress, and other seats. What they're now saying is that in a series of cases, consistently since most recently in 2015 and then again in 2016 and then this year, 2017 and 18, is that they are extremely concerned about the direction that partisan gerrymandering has taken, where not only does the winner get to draw the lines, but they get to cement their control of the legislature for the entire decade, take the choice away from voters, and do it in a way that is tilted, that seems far more skewed than even what had been done in the past. And so a lot of the Supreme Court justices, including Justice Kennedy and Roberts, have expressed real concern about the direction that partisan gerrymandering has taken and have started to say it's a constitutional violation. We just need to figure out how to measure it so that we know it when we see it. That has been at the crux of the two cases that they've now heard. The first one that people will be very familiar with, which was in 2017, Gil v. Whitford on the Wisconsin gerrymandering, which was an example of Republicans doing the deed. And now in Benesek v. Lamone, which is an example of Maryland Democrats doing the dirty deed.
So is it then a case of whether we're talking about that the winner takes all of the spoils or the cheater takes all of the spoils?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think that that's where now the Supreme Court has found that it's one thing when the winner draws the majority of the seats. It's another thing when the winner squeezes out the minority party entirely, skews it so much that it's no longer in alignment with the voters' choices, or voters, even when they have a wave election or they've changed their minds, they have no ability to change those people in office, where our notion of representative government starts to fall flat because voters don't have a real choice when it comes to those elections. And frankly, the thing that probably is scariest of all is that technology has now allowed these map makers to pinpoint voters where they live and to create these maps that are lasting through the entire decade to protect incumbents regardless of what scandal they're subject to, regardless of how out of line they are with voters. It's now so serious that the Supreme Court has finally said, you know what, we said that the winner should take the spoils, but we do think that the manipulation has gotten to such an extreme that we need to rein it in. And so they're taking a series of cases now to try to tackle that question, right, that there is in fact a constitutional violation when partisan gerrymander crosses a certain line. They're trying to figure out where that line is. Today, for the first time, we heard not only Anthony Kennedy joining the four liberal justices to say that there's a serious partisan gerrymander problem. We heard Justice Roberts say it. And that was a big surprise from my perspective to hear him say, it's a constitutional violation. We just need to figure out what the test is.
Just for the benefit of the audience, though, Kathy, let's make it clear what the connections between gerrymandering and the census is, because when we talk about whether it's winner take all the spoils or cheater takes all the spoils, already it looks as though the Trump administration, through the way they're preparing the census, is already cheating.
So, you know, I think what's happening is that there is a huge demographic change that's happening in this country. And one way for a particular party, and I'm just going to say it, the Republican Party, that they have decided that they're going to fight that demographic change is by making sure that only certain people can participate. We're seeing that when it comes to voting laws, right, and the passage of voter suppression laws around the country. We're seeing that in terms of the census, in terms of making sure that only some people fill out the census form, and by adding a citizenship question, we can either scare off other people from filling it out or create such a skewed result that now that number that comes from each state of how many people live in the state and how many people live in a particular community can reflect the number that some people would like to see, which is let's apportion House districts based on a smaller number, which is people who are registered to vote or people who are citizens, and let's also do redistricting based on that. When you start to skew that way, what you do is you have really foreclosed a huge population of people. And it isn't just non-citizens. It's young people. It's people who are newly immigrated here, right? It's people who are just becoming part of our body politic. But when you do that, you're essentially fighting against the demographic change, and you're holding in place the support for the power of the status quo. And in this case, status quo is a Republican Party that is afraid of what that change looks like and doesn't want full participation.
But doesn't the U.S. Constitution, in setting up the census for every 10 years, isn't it fairly clear that they're talking about you have to count all the people in the United States, regardless of whether they're too young to vote or have green cards or are not citizens?
So this is the interaction between the census and redistricting is an important one. And so to play this out, the Constitution absolutely does say that every 10 years that we shall enumerate, that is, we're going to count each person, every person who is in the U.S., right, for purposes of reapportionment and redistricting. Now, the reapportionment is deciding when you've got the House of Representatives, how many representatives go to each state. In California, that would be 53. If our population grows at a pace that's fast enough, we might get more. If it's steady or, you know, it's not growing as fast as other states, we might stay at 53 or even drop, right? So that proportion of House of Representatives is determined by a count of the total population. You can imagine that if certain states have a very high undercount because some people have been chased away by the addition of the citizenship question on the census form, that now all of a sudden the apportionment of seats to California is far less than 53, and our voice is diminished, and our representation in Congress is diminished. There's another result, which is for redistricting, you count everybody so that you can make sure that ultimately when we elect those people to Congress, that whether you come from an urban area or a rural area, everybody's voice is equally weighted. And what the Supreme Court has said is that, yes, you can use total population, but they've left a little question open with a recent case, Evanwell, coming out of Texas, that people may remember, that maybe states could use something else, which is called citizen voting age population. So again, this decision to include citizenship on the form that goes to every single person could be a sneaky way to be able to allow states to say, ha-ha, we've got the data on where citizen voting age people live. Now we're going to redistrict not based on total population, but based on people who are citizens and of voting age. Who does that exclude? It excludes thousands, if not millions, of people who are immigrants, who are young people, who don't satisfy that particular category of citizen voting age people. And it particularly will tend to skew to undercount people who are in urban areas and in favor of places where suburbs and rural areas where there's not that kind of undercount of those people. So you can already see the political dynamics play out where some areas will have a lot of people who are uncounted and therefore unrepresented when it comes to drawing those lines, and districts that tend to skew outward to rural and suburban areas. The kind of imbalance that we're seeing would be huge, and frankly, we're seeing a political strategy, unfortunately, by some cynical members of, you know, party insiders who would like to use the citizen voting aged population to do redistricting at the congressional and state level because they see that as getting their party an advantage.
Well, just in closing, Kathy Fung, you certainly, as I say, I mentioned Attorney General Jeff Sessions has made it clear that he's quite hostile to immigrants. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Stephen Miller, who is one of the closest aides to Trump, he's quite zealous about making America white again. So my sense is that this is so clearly designed, this citizenship question on the new census form, is so clearly designed to intimidate the already intimidated Latinos in this country who are afraid that ICE is going to be knocking on the door at any moment. They're not going to, one, they may not even answer the door, or two, they're afraid of answering the citizenship question because it might lead to them being deported. I mean, it's really cynical what they're doing. And it would seem to me that at the end of the day, what we've got is the state of California today is suing, a number of other states are suing. So in the last minute here, what are the chances?
I think that the state of California and other states who are going to be suing have a pretty strong chance of showing that, just like the Muslim ban, there is intentional discrimination in adding this citizenship question. It is intended and targeted at certain groups of people who are protected minorities in the United States. And if our Constitution means anything, it means that we still have the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause and other protections that ensure that every American is treated equally and nobody is treated as a second-class citizen. I think that the lawsuits in California have a strong chance of prevailing. And I also think that in the midterms in 2018, this question, along with many others, will be at the forefront of people's minds as they think about what direction they want our America to go in. Is it going to be one that's divisive and that tends to separate out who belongs and who doesn't? Or is it going to be one that's inclusive, one that counts everybody, and one that treats everybody as an equal person? Clearly, in 2018, we'll be tackling those questions both in courts and at the polls.
Well, Kathy Fung, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Kathy Fung, who is the Executive Director of California Common Cause. She co-authored and played a leadership role in winning the passage of Proposition 11 to reform California's redistricting process and sits on the Secretary of State's Advisory Committee for the Help America Vote Act. And she was in the Supreme Court today as the justices heard arguments in a watershed gerrymandering case. We're going to take a brief station break, back discussing the meeting between Kim Jong-un and China's President Xi Jinping, which appears to have cleared the way for a summit between North Korea's leader and President Trump in May. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Norper, a Professor, Korea Society Senior Director for Policy, and an Associate at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute and Pacific Forum, CSIS, at Columbia University. A former State Department Senior Analyst, he held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Norper.
Oh, thank you, Ian.
So what do you make of this sudden change in the summit or the possibility of a summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, which seemed to be sort of, nobody was taking it that seriously, but then Kim Jong-un makes a secret trip to meet with Xi Jinping in China, and basically they say the deal's on, and Donald Trump is already very optimistic and keen to start. So the question I would have for you, first of all, Stephen, is this deal was first brought to the White House by the South Koreans, And now it looks like it's going to be brokered by the Chinese, or at the very least, the Chinese have given it a huge impetus. So what is the U.S. role?
Well, I think I would maybe have a slightly different view in that I still see South Korea as the primary driver. I think it's an important step, and I look at it rather optimistically, because what it means is that the North Koreans are willing to put their credibility on the line by upping the ante, by bringing in the Chinese, and on the one sense looking for Chinese guarantees or backing, but on the other hand also saying to Beijing that they see them as a critical part of the process. That's actually a good thing in terms of U.S. role, because Washington has been very determined in terms of trying to make much of the maximum pressure campaign about Chinese co-sponsorship of resolutions in the UN, as well as support on the imposition of sanctions. And those seem to have had some bite. So Washington seems to be determined, and as you mentioned, Trump seems to be signaling that at this point it's a go-ahead. And Kim Jong-un is certainly being more committal publicly by way of this Chinese visit. And the Chinese, no doubt, relish their role because they probably would have felt overlooked otherwise, and see an important diplomatic contribution that is probably in keeping with what the Americans and international community have expected of them on the sanctions front. All of this, though, all of this goes back to Moon Jae-in in South Korea, and a very calculated strategy to bring in the international players in support of Seoul's policy toward Pyongyang.
Well, we don't know what the Japanese position is, do we? And Abe is visiting Washington to go to Mar-a-Lago to meet with President Trump after he gets back from a South American trip in April. So have you heard anything from the Japanese?
I have. I've had some discussions, but I think that the way to look at it is, you know, with the full expectation that Japan and the Abe visit will concentrate on maintaining maximum pressure. They don't want to see any softening of that policy. In fact, they would like to see a step up and inclusion of the issue of abductees. So no doubt they will say this again to Trump, who did mention abductees in the course of some of his prior statements ahead of and during the U.S. presidential visit to Northeast Asia in November of last year. So I think one can assume that the Japanese have, along with the United States, the hardest of lines on this, whereas Russia, China, and South Korea have been pushing more progressively in the way of negotiation. And so expect a harder line message coming out of that meeting, but that's all part and parcel of the process. So Kim Jong-un going to Beijing, meeting with Xi Jinping is one part of the process. Abe communicating to Trump is another. Remember, there's an all-important inter-Korean meeting, a third presidential summit, meaning the two progressive administrations of Kim Dae-jung and Noh Moo-hyun in the early 2000s, and now with President Moon Jae-in, and that will be a historic meeting. Moon will then meet with Trump ostensibly, and then Trump, if all things continue, has committed on this path to meeting with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. So it's a very complex and, at this point, very rapid set of developments.
In terms of their rapid advancement in nuclear testing and missile development, apparently the overheads, the satellites, have picked up a new nuclear reactor. It's estimated that it could produce 20 kilograms of plutonium per year. So apparently Kim gave Xi Jinping some assurances that they would denuclearize. So what does that mean to you?
Well, it means a couple of things. One is that we shouldn't be naive in this process. There is every real reason to believe that they're continuing on their path of missile and nuclear development, and that is a foremost concern, both in terms of what they have and the immediate potential by way of the lethality of improved nuclear and missile capability, but also in terms of concerns about proliferation and concerns about the challenge to the broader non-proliferation regime, what it says to other countries about the path of nuclear development. So it is paramount to try to curtail that. What has been said after the Beijing meeting is that there was a commitment by Kim Jong-un to denuclearize to the Chinese. And one doesn't know about the accuracy of that completely, but if there was some sort of statement in that regard, keep in mind that both his father, Kim Jong-il, and grandfather, Kim Il-sung, made similar commitments about not developing nuclear capability and about the importance of a nuclear weapons-free Korea Peninsula. So it may be seen a bit different through the North Korean lens. So trying to find a way to stem that is of critical importance. That's why negotiation is so important. And remember the path we were on before the Olympic moment, which may have turned into an Olympic movement towards peaceful negotiation on this issue, is one of confrontation. And the cost there would be severe. So de-escalating the crisis is critically important. And that's why all of these different portions of trying to secure a negotiation process that works by the time that Trump and Kim Jong-un sit down, should it occur, is so very critical.
Well, the North Korean official news agency, KCNA, made no mention of Kim's pledge to Xi Jinping to denuclearize, or did they discuss the anticipated meeting with Trump? But you were a senior analyst in the State Department, Stephen Norper, and the State Department's been hollowed out. The NSC has been hollowed out in terms of its Korea expertise. The top official has quit recently. So who's doing the groundwork? Who's doing laying the diplomatic groundwork here? My understanding is that it's Mike Pompeo over at the CIA has a team working the back channels to set up this summit.
Mm-hmm. So there is an interagency process, and it's basically left to Pompeo's team, which one would assume is incoming in his role of Secretary of State, and then also those on the National Security Council, the Senior Director for Asia at the NSC, and his assistant on the issue. But you're right to point out that there's a capacity issue, and there's a problem that even predates this of many of the first-generation Korea analysts having retired from government or moved on, and that's just stepped up with the hollowing out, as you describe it, of the State Department. So there is a real need for expertise, and there's a need for advisory. It's important that we really be considering the full range of plans, backups, contingencies, and we'll see how that goes. Now, counter to that, you're dealing with a transactional president who seems to feel that he can strike the deal and that doesn't necessarily entail the traditional manner of negotiations where you would have senior advisors and diplomats working to groom a process where you might ultimately have the heads of state meet. So this is almost in reverse, where you would have a senior most level meeting, perhaps putting a negotiation process into play and leaving the details to those who are active in government and would have to carry that out. But do we need more talent in on the North Korea issue? Certainly. That's really paramount. Not having an ambassador in place in Seoul is a critical deficit. And so trying to shore up our capabilities, especially with 2 short months remaining before a dialogue like this would take place, is something to keep in mind.
But is it concerning that Donald Trump may be more prone to making a deal that makes him look good as opposed to being in America's interest? Because we know he is quite narcissistic, to put it bluntly, and he's also mercurial. So you really, given who your principal is in these summit meetings, if you're staffing this up, you'd want some real heft in that staff work, wouldn't you, to make sure that he wasn't flattered like he was by Xi Jinping on the recent trip to China.
You would hope there would be more of a team in place, and it's a bit surprising to see both the step down of Tillerson and McMaster. And in their place, you have Pompeo and John Bolton. Bolton certainly is seen as the hardest line player to have entered the scene. And that means that the chances for success on a negotiation could go down because he thinks that basically the U.S. president should demand the immediate removal of weaponry, and anything short of that, that there shouldn't be any give and take to the process. And he's written on that quite publicly and made public statements to that effect. So how closely will Donald Trump listen to the new national security advisor on this? Will that somehow lessen the desire to strike at a deal? But clearly he feels that he'll be able to make a difference where his predecessors haven't. And as you point out, that may be a narcissistic tendency. But remember, ultimately, he will declare whether that meeting with Kim Jong-un has been a success or not. And the South Koreans are watching very, very cautiously and trying to manage a process where you're dealing with two very large personalities in both Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, who are less predictable and more belligerent in tone. And that's very hard for U.S. government professionals. It's very hard for South Korean diplomats and the South Korean administration. But all of this, in terms of moving to a process of some dialogue, again, is much better than the alternative, which was the move towards a military strike. And we may be back at that at some point. Part of the danger of this process is that it raises the level to such a degree, because you're dealing with the U.S. president and that imprimatur and the meeting with the North Korean leader, that if this does fail, then the alternative is most likely military conflict. It puts things at a seriously high level that can lead to conflict.
Well, nobody wants to be a killjoy, and in an ironic way, that may well be a major impetus. In other words, what's waiting in the wings here is if Kim comes back empty-handed, even though he controls the minds of the people through massive and ubiquitous propaganda, he still may feel the need to overcome the fact that he's got a black eye and strike out. And then on our side, you've got the incoming hawks, hardliners like Pompeo and, in particular, John Bolton. So the message there is the U.S. position is going to harden, not soften. So this might well work to get both sides focused, right? I can't figure out what's happening on the North Korean side. I think most people can't. But what do you
think? Right, and no one really knows how Kim Jong-un would be able to continue his appeal, which has had so much emphasis on the nuclear and missile development in the early stages of his Pyongyang or two-track policy, which is nuclear weapons development and then economic modernization. Perhaps he's moving on to economic modernization. But in terms of Trump, I've mentioned, you know, most of us try to realize and accept the transactional aspect of this president, but he sees himself as also a transitional president. And he wants to be seen as Reagan-esque. If you take a look at John Bolton's last piece from 2 weeks ago, he writes about a lineage of Roosevelt to Reagan. And I'm certain that's what he'll convey to the president. And so the president will want to see himself transitional in that way. So stranger things have happened. And sometimes in the history of U.S. foreign policy, clearly the Beijing opening is what comes to mind first, that it's Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon who opened the door with China. And there may be then a desire by Donald Trump to make this his China-Nixon moment.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Norper, it's always seemed that there's really no military solution to this, and particularly with the citizens of Seoul being held hostage to any escalation, either through conventional war or even nuclear war. So at the end of the day, my understanding has always been that the best way to bring down the Kim regime, it's a despicable gangster family, a kleptocracy. Mm-hmm. What they do is just so horrible to their own people. So the idea that if Kim comes off as a legitimate member on the world stage, then forget about the North Korean people have mm-hmm. lives improving. And my sense has always been that that's the Kim's Achilles heel. I mean, he's more afraid of his own people getting soap operas from South Korea than mm-hmm. anything else, because that breaks through the hermetic seal of delusion and cradle-to-grave propaganda. So what's your sense there, that Would that be the final irony, that this deal would seal the fate of the North Korean people as opposed to lead them on a path towards being liberated and able to breathe the free air as most of the planet does?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you make several good points, and I think the fact of the matter is he has to deal with the regime that has now quite lethal nuclear capability and the ability to deliver that via intercontinental ballistic missiles. And by Pompeo's account, they're near there, right? His latest statement, again, has been a matter of months in terms of perfecting some of that ICBM technology. So trying to find an immediate way to stem that is all important. But you're right about the more problematic and endemic aspect of the process, that you have an illegitimate regime that controls its people, that is guilty of gross human rights abuses, that has 130,000 imprisoned in gulag-type labor camps, crimes that the 2014 United Nations Commission of Inquiry report labeled as Nazi-era atrocities. And you've seen mention of this at the State of Union Address and the testimonial of North Korean defectors. So on top of concern about nuclear and missile, chemical weapons and human rights, you have some very, very difficult aspects. But in that sense, looking to Seoul for a managed process that deals effectively with integration and ultimately unification is really important. And trying to find ways to employ a 70-year-old ROK U.S. alliance that was born in blood from the Korean War and that brings in international actors in effective and constructive ways is important. And ultimately, then, the fate of the North Korean regime may be that of those countries who disappeared in 1989 when we saw the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall. And one can't help but think that they may go the page of history. Remember, in 1979, South Korea's president at the time, Park Chung-hee, was assassinated over dinner by his intelligence chief. So the chance of palace coups and intrigues, it's all within range of possibility, even if not probability. And so the young leader may be acting based on economic pragmatism or feeling the bite of sanctions or wanting to stem dissent within his own political environment that we may not even know of or that may be even at lowest levels. But as you point out, information sets people free, and information is already cracking North Korean society. And the more that North Koreans learn of the advances of their brethren to the south, of the disparities of their condition, their desire for freedom can only grow.
Well, Stephen Dorper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Dorper, who's a professor, Korea Society Senior Director for Policy, and an associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute and Pacific Forum, CSIS, at Columbia University. A former State Department senior analyst, he held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.